listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers Podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And this week, we are talking about a newish board game that I just got recently that I've played a ton of, that I've been quite enjoying. And we recently played it together. And I had a good time. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
But Matthew, tell them what game we're talking about this week.
We are talking about Sanctum, designed by Philippe Nadeau and published in 2019 by CGE, or Czech Games Edition.
All right. So for a short description of what Sanctum is about, in Sanctum, players fight demons, gain experience, collect equipment, and travel to the heart of the demon-infested country to face off against the demon lord. The player who survives the fight with the demon lord with the most health wins. It's a very short description, but we're going to get a little bit more into detail on how the game is played and what the objectives are in our deeper dive. So let's just get to it.
Yeah.
I guess, first of all, we're going to probably mention two games a lot in this review. One of them is a game called Takenoko, which I don't think we've done an episode on, but it's a game where
you're thinking of Tokaido.
Tokaido. Yeah, not Takenoko. Tokaido.
We haven't done an episode on either.
We haven't discussed Tokaido, but it's a game where you travel in a straight line along a board, leapfrogging over your other players in the game. The idea is that the way the movement works is there's like stages in a straight line, and when you move to the front of the line. Unless you're at the front already, then you take a step forward. The other game is Diablo, because this game seems to be pretty heavily inspired by Diablo. Well, it doesn't ever mention that for obvious reasons.
Actually, the Board Game Geek page mentions that it's inspired by like classic hack and slash games.
Okay.
Which pretty much like means Diablo in this case. Like, sure. It's not saying it's not inspired by these types of video games, it just doesn't name them.
Right. I mean, yeah, it doesn't specifically name Diablo or maybe a more recent game like Path of Exile, but a lot of elements that exist in those games are in this game in, you know, board game form. In some cases, probably without there really having to be a reason for it to be in the game. Like, for example, there are acts to this game. Like, if you play the full four-player version of this game, you go through acts 1 through 5 and then face the Demon Lord at the end of Act 5. But those are just like referencing the boards that you travel across, because each, you know, act is like a board with a number of spots on it that you walk across. So there's no real reason to call them acts, but because games like Diablo and Path of Exile are dividing their story into act structures, I think that's why this game decided to use that terminology, right. As well as make a number of other design choices. It's a competitive game where players are walking along the same path, encountering demons, defeating those demons to gain equipment and experience, equipping that equipment to power themselves up so that they can face more powerful demons, and then eventually facing off at the very end of the game versus the Demon Lord. Players fight different sort of encounters with the Demon Lord. It's not like one big cooperative fight against one enemy. Each player has their own challenges that they must face to defeat the Demon Lord. And then at the end of the game, the player who won that fight with the most health wins. It's weird how the game kind of describes this scenario, because the game says, like, if you defeated the Demon Lord, you should consider yourself a winner. However, the true winner of the game is the player who finishes with the most health. So it is competitive, right. But, you know, I guess the game is sort of telling you you should pat yourself on the back if you manage to actually defeat the Demon Lord in the end, even if you don't win.
It is pretty difficult to beat the Demon Lord in my experience, especially your first time.
Yes. Yeah, I'm surprised at how difficult it is, especially in the 3 and 4 player versions of the game. So, right. And I played mostly 2-player, but recently I've played it in 3-player modes a couple of times. And yeah, the difficulty does spike, and we'll go into that a little bit later. But just to describe more about the game. So there are 4 playable characters in the game. There is the dancer, the hunter, the outlaw, and the barbarian. I don't think those are their exact names, but I think dancer and outlaw are for sure correct, and then hunter and barbarian. Each character starts with a different amount of focus and stamina, which are the resources that you use to activate your equipment's abilities, which we'll go into in a moment. And each player has a different skill tree, or each character has a different skill tree, rather. So the way that the skill tree is set up is each character has three columns for their skills, and each column has three skills within it, the skill one, skill two, and skill three. The columns are the red column, green column, and blue column. Each skill in those columns has a different number of gems that are matching the color of the column. Sometimes they'll have a white gem on them, which is a wild card color gem. But for the most part, all the abilities in the red column will have red gems on them. When you defeat demons, you gain experience, and you spend that experience by moving gems of the matching color to that experience up on the skill tree. So if you move a gem off of the first ability in the red column, we'll call it red one, then that goes into your skill gem pool. But if you were to move a gem off of the third ability, it goes up onto the second ability. So trying to unlock higher abilities in your skill tree means that it'll take longer for you to unlock lower abilities, right, because you unlock an ability when you remove all of the gems from it.
Right. When you remove all the gems the first time.
The first time, yeah.
If you unlock the first ability and then you move gems up from the second ability, you still keep that first ability you unlocked.
Right. Okay, so the way that you get gems is you fight demons. And the way that you fight demons is by moving across the board. So on the first space of each of the acts, you are instructed to populate that act with five sets of demons. Sometimes a set will be a pair of demons. Sometimes a set will just be one single demon. And then after you move, you pick up one set of demons and put it onto your player placard to fight later. Right. And then, every space thereafter will add a new set of demons on the act board that you're on. And like I said at the beginning, the way you move is if you're not at the front of the line, you move to the front of the line. If you are at the front of the line, you move one space forward. So you move, you add a set of demons to the board, and then you take a set of demons to fight later. At this point, it's probably good to mention that the three actions that you can take on your turn are move, which is what we've just described, fight, which is where you roll your combat dice to try and defeat the demons, and then rest, which is the third action, which lets you recover your stamina and focus. Okay. Fighting demons. Each demon has dice pictured on them, and you start out the game with two dice, and you'll acquire more dice as you go. And all you're trying to do is roll the dice to match the dice on demons. However, if you don't roll the exact numbers, you have abilities that you spend your stamina and focus on to either adjust the dice so that you can hit the demon, or block the damage from the demon if you fail to actually defeat it.
Right. Yeah. So like on your character, when you start off, I believe every character has one ability that can raise or lower a die by one, and one that can raise or lower a die by two. And then every character also starts with the ability to block some damage.
Yeah, every character starts with the same abilities. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, raise or lower a die by one, raise or lower a die by two. Those both cost focus to use, just one focus to do either ability. And then the other abilities are block one damage with one stamina, block two damage with two stamina, and block one damage with two stamina, or two focus.
Specifically abilities that require focus use blue colored circles, abilities that require stamina use red colored circles, and some abilities, like you said, can take either, and those have purple circles.
Yes. So when you use an ability, you move a stamina or focus from your pool onto that ability, and then it is spent until you either rest or you consume a potion. And you can consume potions before combat to move stamina and focus from your abilities back into your pool, which gives you that stamina or focus back and also makes that skill available. Just one stamina or focus per potion. Okay. So resting, like we said, it returns all your stamina and focus. It also allows you to equip items. And items will grant you more abilities that you can spend your stamina and focus on. You spend gems to equip your items. And again, you obtain those gems by moving them off of your skills. So once a gem has moved all the way off of your skill tree into your skill pool, that means it's available for you to equip items with. And the way that you equip items, it's kind of flexible. Once you've spent a gem to equip an item, that doesn't mean it's spent for good. You can always use it later to equip a different item by unequipping the item it was being used to equip.
Right. Think of it like whenever you rest, you take all the gems you have unlocked from experience, and then you can spend those however you wish on the equipment you have, and then, yeah, you can just take them off the equipment when you rest again.
Mm-hmm.
And each equipment has a gem cost listed on it that usually requires just one type of gem, sometimes one type and then some white gems.
No, the equipment never costs white gems.
Really?
It only ever costs.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
But you can use white gems. You can use white gems to equip any color of equipment.
Right. And you actually start the game with one white gem in your inventory.
Yes.
And when you use that to equip a weapon or item for the first time, it gives you another die you can roll during combats.
Right. So how do you get equipment, you ask?
Oh, wait. Well, on. I wanted to say there is one other combat mechanic we didn't mention that's important.
What's that?
Which is rage.
We can go into that in a moment.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you get equipment by defeating the demon. So there are three strengths of demon that you'll encounter throughout the game. There's like level 1 demons, level 2 demons, and level 3 demons. Any given demon will either be a red demon, a blue demon, or a green demon. And whatever level that demon is, it gives you that much experience in that color. Also, on the backside of that demon's card, there will be an equipment. And once you defeat the demon, then you flip it over and add it to your equipment inventory. You know, the equipment on the backside of the demon will be the same level as the demon and cost the same number of gems to equip as the demon gave you an experience. So a level 1 red demon will give you a level 1 red equipment that costs 1 red gem to equip. There are 5 types of equipment in the game. There are helmets, chest pieces, boots, weapons, and charms. And each player has the same number of slots for equipment. You have 1 helmet slot, 1 chest slot, 1 boot slot, 1 charm slot, and 2 weapon slots. When you rest and equip equipment, you can also choose to get rid of any extra equipment and convert them into potions, 1-to-1, regardless of the level of the equipment.
Yeah.
Okay, so one more battle mechanic that we didn't mention yet, other than all the mechanics that you can unlock via your skill tree, is a mechanic called Rage, which essentially it's this tile that every character has. You flip it, you start with it face up. You flip it face down to change any die in the combat you're having to any number you want. So it's very good for defeating demons. And it remains face down unless you finish a combat with dice left over that you haven't spent and demons that are still alive that you could have been fighting, that were in your combat pool of demons.
Right.
Because again, after you move, you collect demons and they go to your combat pool, which you fight those demons when you choose the fight action. You don't have to beat them every time. So that's how you get rage back. So that's the basics of how to play this game. You move, collect demons, fight the demons, you get experience and equipment. You rest to equip the equipment, and your experience will unlock abilities, unique abilities for each character. Each character has sort of a mechanical identity of what their abilities generally do.
Oh, we should mention how the demon works, the final boss.
Okay, so once you get to Act 5, you get one last pair of demons that you get to fight. And then once you have defeated all of the demons that you've collected up to that point, so you have 0 demons left in your demon pool, then you may breach the gates of the cathedral where the demon lord awaits. So the first player to do this will face 2 little roadblocks before fighting the demon lord called Roars. Every other player has the option then to abandon any of the demons that they have remaining in their demon pool and join them, or they can wait a turn, try and defeat the demons that they still have to get that last bit of experience. But every turn that a player waits, they face an extra roar. which will be some sort of minor penalty before they go into the final fight with the demon.
Right.
So once everybody has progressed forward, all of the roars are resolved. Everybody gets, well, before all the roars are resolved, everyone gets one last rest to get their, you know, resources together and finalize their weapon build for the final fight. Then they face the roars, then they fight the demon. And the demon is one long combat that will require multiple turns to complete. Because the way that you fight, there's two kinds of demon cards. There's the roar cards, which after the initial roar serve as just dice that you have to roll to defeat the demon. And then there's also swipe cards, or maybe claw cards. I'm not rage. I think they're called rage cards, which are face down. And on their underside, they have more dice that you have to roll to defeat the demon, but you don't know exactly what those dice numbers are. And you have to face 5 roar cards and 4 rage cards to defeat the demon.
Right. The rage cards also have a negative effect that appears when you flip them over.
Yeah, most of the time they do. So between the 5 roar cards, which always have 2 dice on them, and the 4 rage cards, which could have anywhere from 2 to 3 dice on them that you have to match in order to defeat that portion of the demon, it's going to take like 3 to 4 turns to defeat the demon. And all of the face-up roar cards will deal 2 damage if you haven't defeated them yet. And all the face-down rage cards, it depends. It could be anywhere from 1 to 3 damage, but they only deal damage to you if they're face-up. And they're only face up when you're actually fighting that part of the demon. You start at, you put them all in a line, alternating, you know, roar, rage, roar, rage, roar, rage. You start at one end of the line and you sort of move your figure along the line, defeating each portion of the demon as you go. And you defeat the demon once you've defeated the last card at the other end of the line.
Right.
Okay. Each player starts with 10 health. You can lose health by fighting the demons during the first 5 acts of the game, but if you play carefully enough, then you'll be fine. You shouldn't lose any health during the main portion of the game. And then once you get to the demon fight, you have your 10 health. If you lose all of your health, you die, and you fail to defeat the Demon King. And if you defeat the Demon King, the player with the most health wins.
Right. There's one more thing we didn't mention that is actually really important for strategy, which is the blessings.
Okay.
These are kind of like achievements, where there are 3 sets of these that track certain game progress. And what it is if when a player reaches that progress, they get the appropriate blessing if they're the first one to reach it. So these are having multiple gems of the same color. So it's, I believe it's 2 gems of 2 colors, 3 gems of 2 colors, and then 4 gems of 2 colors.
Mm-hmm.
There is equipping a certain strength of equipment, which I think is 5, 7, 10 total levels.
It's 4, 7, 10.
4, 7, 10 total levels of equipment, and then unlocking 5, 7, 10 skills.
No, it's 3, 5, 7.
Okay, sorry, what he said.
It's okay. So three skills, 5 skills, 7 skills.
Yeah, for each of those, the first one to reach that achievement gets a blessing, which is this face-down tile. Mm-hmm. And during the final fight, I believe right before the roars appear, then you reveal those, and you get to use those as resources throughout that final area, that final phase. Yeah, they can give
you extra stamina and focus, they can give you extra blocks, extra dice manipulation.
Yeah. There are also bonus blessings for the first person to reach a tier 2 blessing and a tier 3 blessing.
Right. So having like 4, having like 5 levels of equipment, or 7 levels of equipment rather, is the tier 2 blessing for the equipment track. If you're the first person to get a tier 2 blessing, like for example 7 levels of equipment, then you also get a bonus blessing.
Yeah.
I guess the last thing to say is that you start with 2 dice. You get an extra die the first time you equip a piece of equipment. And then there are 2 particular spaces along the board where you will get bonus dice called Divine Intervention. In the 3-player game, that would be, there's a bonus die in Act 2, and there's a bonus die at the beginning of Act 5. So you end the game with about 5 dice, Plus, sometimes you can get bonus dice from your abilities. Okay.
Okay, I think that's it.
So, just real quick, I want to go over the sort of mechanical identities for each class in the game. So, the barbarian is sort of a... I mean, they're a barbarian. The way that they work is they focus mostly on getting stamina through their skill tree, because there is ways to get stamina and focus through your skill tree, and they mostly get stamina through there. And then their abilities revolve around taking risks in combat, but being able to deal with them. So they have like some abilities that help them absorb damage. They have some abilities that give them extra rage, and their bonus die, they can use it in combat, but the demon that they use it on automatically strikes back at you, even if you would defeat it. The outlaw has mostly to do with potions. So they have an ability that gives them a bonus potion slot. They have abilities that let them use potions in the middle of combat rather than just at the beginning. And they also have an ability that lets them spend a potion to use a bonus die for that combat. The ranger doesn't have any sort of focus on stamina or focus. They're sort of like a multi-talented individual, but their main... if I had to give them a mechanical identity, is they can use gems as stamina and focus for the purposes of, you know, activating their abilities or blocking damage. And therefore, they can also, they have an ability that also lets them equip level one equipment for free so that they can free up their gems.
They're more of a weapon master archetype.
Sort of. The outlaw is also a weapon master because they have one ability that lets them get a free level three piece of equipment.
Yeah.
Without having to defeat a demon. But the ranger, they're resourceful with like lesser equipment is sort of how I'd put it. And then the dancer has sort of a focus on focus. So they use a lot of they can gain a lot of focus through their abilities, and they can be very resourceful with it. They have an ability that lets them double stack focus on abilities. They have an ability that lets them use a focus to block one damage, and then later on they can take that focus as if it were still in their focus pool and spend it somewhere else. And then they have to do a lot with dice manipulation. I forgot to say the ranger's extra die. How does the ranger's extra die work again? The ranger uses their extra die by spending one focus. However, that focus just remains spent. The dancer gets to use their extra die simply by manipulating it. They roll it before combat, but they can't use the die unless they've manipulated it with an ability of some sort. But they have plenty of other abilities in their skill tree that help them manipulate dice without having to spend too much focus. If I had to rank them tier list wise, the dancer, I think, is the most powerful simply because it's easiest to use her extra die, followed by the ranger, who I think has the most useful skills, followed by... I'm not exactly sure between the outlaw or the barbarian which one is better. I would, my gut says barbarian, because having that extra rage is pretty useful, and their extra die can be less taxing. But outlaw.
I feel like the outlaw is better personally. They don't have to jump through as many hoops for their die manipulation, which I was going to get into when we talk about like the individual characters themselves and how to play them.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I could see it going either way.
So you want to get... I want to get into some general gameplay like right. That apply to any character.
Yeah.
Real quick, before we get into the specific characters. Okay, so a couple of gameplay tips for this game. Plan your skills ahead. So look at your skill tree, figure out which skills synergize with each other, see if you can stick to only two of the columns in that strategy, or like if you have to get a skill from outside of those two columns, hopefully it's only just one. So plan that ahead, because it's important to pick the right colors of monsters to fight, so you're getting the right experience to unlock your skills. Another tip is to keep tempo, because if you're at the front, you get to move forward one space. And so if the other players are doing that, they're moving forward one space at the front and you're staying behind, that means you're losing tempo, which means you'll have less experience than your opponents by the end of the game. And then also, in a similar vein of keeping tempo, take calculated risks. So don't like move, fight, rest. Try and fight fights that you know you can't actually beat in one turn, just because, you know, it's still safe to fight that many fights. Essentially what I'm saying is like try to work in more movement than you think you need, because moving means having more demons, but it also means not falling behind turn wise.
Right. There's a limited number of spaces, and so theoretically whoever travels the total most spaces will have more demons that they can fight.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that gives them more experience and equipment and whatnot.
Right. Yeah. The more demons you fight, the more experience and equipment you have, which means the more skills you unlock. Also, it's important to pay attention to what your opponents are doing blessing wise and see which blessings you can acquire before your opponents can. So whether that's, you know, having two and two of each of two different colors of gems, or, you know, four levels of equipment, just be aware of that. And that could inform a turn every now and then. Like, you know, you could move and keep tempo with everybody else and get a couple extra demons before you fight, or you could rest right now and get the first tier of the equipment level blessings, which, you know, could be useful.
Right. I wanted to mention that block is extremely important for the boss.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you'll be taking at least six or so damage every turn from the boss.
Yeah, so well, I would say a good rule of thumb is you want to be able to block 8 damage on the first turn of combat against the Demon Lord. And then the next turn of combat, you want to then be able to block 4 to 6 damage.
Right.
Because all of those face-up cards deal at least 2 damage, and you'll probably be facing 4 of them on your first turn. And you'll probably be facing another 2 or 3 of them on your next turn. So just being able to block 8 on that first turn and then have enough potions or enough leftover stamina and abilities to block 6 the next turn.
Right. So in my experience, the best cards for doing so are equipments that let you spend 2 resources to block 5 damage or 6 damage. I think at least each color has at least 1 equipment that can do this. That
yeah,
can spend either 2 focus or 2 stamina or 2 whatever to block 5.
Generally, the hat, torso, armor, and boot slots in the third level of items, or the third level of items that come from the third level of demons, will have that much block accessible to you.
Right. So those are very important, and I think that's like the main thing you want to make sure you can equip when you're going into that final fight.
Right.
And just making sure you can block things. Also, you definitely want potions, just because, so even if you only have 1 equipment that can block 5 damage, having 2 potions to get rid of those resources there lets you block 5 damage again.
Right. You'll pretty much always have a full inventory of potions for the final fight with the Demon Lord, because you just get so much extra equipment as you go through the game.
Right.
But in the middle of the game, it's also important not to forget about your potions, because they mean the difference between like resting before a fight or just going directly into the fight, because you have potions to free up some abilities, some stamina and focus, so that you can actually safely take that fight.
Yeah, I've definitely found myself resting more often than not in order to remove resources from my skills, so I can, like, block things more than I have resting to specifically equip something.
To put that in another way, be decisive when you're equipping equipment and make potions more often than not. Like, it's better, like, the first time you rest, you might have, like, an extra hat or an extra weapon or something. And you might think, like, oh, but, you know, I might need that weapon later on. I think over the... For the most part, you're not going to need that. It's better for you to change it into a potion so that you can skip a rest later on in the game. A 1-turn difference could be big in this game, because there's not many turns between you starting your adventure and facing off against the Demon Lord.
Exactly.
So on the front of each demon, it tells you what kind of piece of equipment you'll be getting if you defeat it. So keep those in mind. I think it's the color of the demon is more important than the type of equipment you're getting. But you don't want to be like me and be, you know, fighting the Demon Lord not wearing a piece of chest armor. Like, you want to at least have one piece of armor in every slot.
Yeah.
When you face off against a demon lord, most likely.
Or at least a hat and chest armor.
Maybe. Or chest and boots. You just want to be able to block that damage that we said earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, so for individual character tips.
Right. So, with Outlaw, I think the thing that makes them good is partially the poison dagger, which is a cheap skill that says that you can turn ones into sixes and sixes into ones. Because this also means that you can turn sixes into twos or ones into fives using a plus or minus one.
Mm-hmm.
But the big thing is that the poison dagger doesn't cost any resources to use once you have it unlocked.
Sure. It's a free ability.
Yeah.
It's also important because there's certain equipment later in the game that will only increase dice or only decrease the number on dice. You start with two abilities that are plus or minus, but many abilities throughout the course of the game that you unlock from your equipment will just be either plus or minus. It won't be both. So so being able to change a one into a six means that, you know, something that says only plus, you can change a six to a one and then plus that one into what you need it.
Exactly.
And vice versa for minuses. So yeah, it's very useful. It's free. I'd say also being able to refresh your rage before, or as if you don't have enough dice to complete a combat, the outlaw has an ability that refreshes your rage, which is very useful because rage is sort of like a free ability. It's like you can use rage rather than use a stamina or focus to get the die face you want. And so getting that rage back really easily for free is very useful. It's like having a free potion every turn.
It's also especially really useful for the boss where you almost never have enough dice to complete the fight.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You'll refresh your rage at least three times for free in the final fight.
Yeah.
I think the extra potion slot is very much worth it for the for the outlaw, because having five potions for the demon fight can make the difference between blocking that last amount of damage versus not blocking it.
Right.
Or and then similarly, being able to use potions in the middle of combat is very useful because it makes you not have to predict what you're going to need. You can just use it when you need it.
Yeah.
I think the last skill I think that it's kind of useful on the outlaw, but is a little harder to get because most of the skills we've said until now are all red and green skills. But the one blue skill at the top that gives you a free level 3 item can be pretty useful, especially really early in the game, because it could help you get really fast along the 4 and 7 and 10 levels of equipment track.
Right. It also means that if you get one of the items that lets you block a lot of damage, it lets you take significant risks in the mid game,
right?
Because you can block a huge amount of damage, so you can take like 6 or 7 monsters into your monster pool and then block all the damage you need to take.
Yeah, you can see what the top demon on the deck of demons is. So if that top, you know, level 3 demon on the level 3 demon deck is one of those pieces of armor, a headpiece, torso piece, or a boot, then I would say it's for sure very valuable to take that ability right away.
Especially if it's blue.
Yeah.
Because then you can equip it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so for Barbarian, I think it's similarly helpful to have the rage focus. The Barbarian's rage, they get a second rage tile. They're the only class that gets two. And they have an ability that refreshes their rage under the circumstance that at the start of combat, your opponent has a hit marker on it. So we didn't mention, but if a demon takes multiple dice to defeat and you're only able to get some of those dice into combat, then you get to mark those off with hit markers. So the next time you fight those demons, you don't have to worry about those hits. You've already landed them. So the Barbarian gets to refresh their rage if there's already a hit marker on the demon. And I think those are in the same track, so that's right. Pretty easy to get.
You can only refresh one rage tile at a time. But like a really easy thing you can do, for example, is on the first turn of the demon fight, like it's very likely that you won't be able to use all of your dice, so that means that you would refresh a tile from having not enough dice, or from having leftover dice, I mean, and then next turn you would refresh a tile from having hit markers. So right. You can still kind of refresh both of them over the course of two turns.
And hopefully you can plan it that you've got both of your rage when you go into the demon fight, right. So you only have to worry about doing that trick the second turn.
Yeah.
And then hopefully by the third or fourth turn you won't have to worry about stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would also say that the Barbarian's extra die is possible to use, especially if you get the skill that says they block one damage from a demon that they've dealt damage to. Because the Barbarian gets to automatically set their die and hit a demon with it, but then they face the damage that the demon would put against them. So being able to block one of those damage for free makes having this extra die worth it, in my opinion.
This is especially worth it during the mid-game, because it's another one that lets you take a lot of demons and then deal damage to them, and then you don't have to spend as many resources blocking. Because, mm-hmm. If you have three demons that deal two damage, and you kill one of them and hit the other two once, then you only have to block two damage left over, because you're ignoring two from the remaining two demons. During the boss, it really only saves one damage per turn, which is still a free block. But that's still pretty strong, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, for the Ranger, I think it's most important to focus on the red and blue tracks, especially because I think it's in the blue track, the Ranger has an ability that lets you use red and blue gems as focus and stamina. So you can have a really large focus and stamina pool as the Ranger, just by focusing on those two tracks, having excess gems, and then having the skill that lets you spend them in that way. And it's especially helpful to have a lot of extra blue gems and focus because of the Ranger's ability to use an extra die by spending a focus.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to do a blue focus character to take full advantage of that extra die.
Something that's worth noting is that most of the charms give you about two, or I don't know if they can give you three.
They most can. Of them.
Okay.
The,
yeah.
The tier they give you, three. Charms can give you three the tier three blue charm can give you three focus.
Yeah, the blue and red charms will tend to give you extra focus or stamina based on whatever level it is. So tier one gives you one, tier two gives you two, so on. That skill that the Ranger has just ignores that. You don't need to worry about charms if you have that skill,
right?
Because you're essentially paying three gems for three focus anyways.
Mm-hmm. The Ranger has an ability, I think it's in the red column, that lets them equip all level one equipment for free. That one's kind of useful just for equipping a level one charm and getting an extra,
that's
an extra
true.
Focus out of it. And also it will free up, some of your gems for all your other abilities.
Yeah.
The Dancer, so their die, they can only use their extra die if they've modified it, but they have at least one skill that lets them do that for free, because they have a skill that lets them change any one die to match another one of their die, which is very powerful. So you can just use that on your extra die, change it to match another die, and now you can use it.
Right.
The Ranger also has an ability that lets them treat all pluses and minuses and all minuses and pluses on their abilities, which can make certain low level equipment very worthwhile. So there's a level one blue weapon that gives you plus one, plus two, or plus three abilities for spending your focus to do that on dice. Which, to anyone else, that's a little narrow, in what it can do to your dice. It can't do anything really for sixes or fives. But if you're the Dancer and you have that ability, then your level one blue weapon is exactly the same as a similar level three blue weapon. So you can save a lot of gems that way. You can equip lower level equipment and get a ton of more use out of it. It essentially just gives you more gems to equip higher level armor with, which is very good.
Right.
The double stacking blue tokens on your abilities is also a pretty powerful ability.
Yeah. Definitely saves on potions.
Do you have any more strategy tips?
Not really. Not really.
Okay, yeah. Just keep tempo, focus on your builds, focus on what your opponents are doing so you can keep up with them and take those blessings.
Yeah.
And be prepared to fight the demon. All right, so let's talk about the design of the game. But before we talk about that, I guess we can do our quick little mid-episode plugs.
Yeah. All right. Well, you can follow us on social media at BG Broscast on Facebook and Twitter. You can go to our website at bgbcast.com, where you can find links to all of our episodes, as well as tags. We tag all the episodes so you can find related episodes if we talk about like another board game or something similar. Let's see. I'm not usually the one that does this part. You can follow.
You can find a link to our TeePublic store, tpublic.com/user/bgbcast. And you can follow us on Twitch.
Yeah, I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I know I'm switching up my schedule from about 12 p.m. Central Time to 3 p.m. Central Time. That part's also kind of in the air. I stream speedruns, a lot of roguelites, deck builders, playing a lot of Slay the Spire recently. I've been playing Fortune Street every Friday, which is a particularly devilish board game video game that we did an episode on. And that's been enjoyable. And through that Twitch page, you can also find a Discord server where you can talk to us and other fans of our work.
All right. You can also follow me on Twitch. I stream generally on Wednesdays, just whatever I'm feeling like streaming. Twitch.tv/RadicalHawks. That's twitch.tv/Radical, H-A-W-K-Z. Okay.
Okay.
Talking about the design of the game.
Yes.
So I think they did their best to mimic or make a board game version of things that games like Diablo offer you.
Yeah.
Obviously missing the co-op aspect of Diablo, but having everything else to it. And I think they do a pretty successful job. I think I was skeptical. I'm always kind of skeptical with a board game that tries to distill a more complicated game system.
Maybe I'm spoiled by Level 99 and D. Brad Talton.
I don't know. I mean, but even then, it sometimes like with Battlecon, which attempts to mimic like a fighting game, it doesn't do it in the same way. Like it kind of more mimics like a minutia aspect of the fighting game and examines it. It doesn't make you feel like you're playing a fighting game, you know, emotionally, at least personally. I mean, like there's still the reading aspect, but it's not as like high, it's not fast or intense,
right? There's
or flashy.
Usually
it's really slow.
With adapting video games that are real time into a board game format that is turn-based, you have to sort of think about how you're adapting the aesthetics and the mechanics and the feel. Those are like the three fields that you have to adapt. I think this game kind of has the aesthetics down. It's good enough.
Well, I think what I'm trying to get at is like, either you do something like Level 99 Games does, and you sort of like make a take on it, like a commentary, yeah. Like you distill it into something else that works as a board game, versus this game, which just sort of tries to do everything the exact same way, just in board game form. Like you do much of the same things that you would in Diablo, just in a board game form. And I think this game is successful at it, which surprised me. Like it makes me nervous to think of somebody taking something that's, you know, automated by electronics and can be way, way more complicated, and bring it down to this level of simplicity and make it feel, you know, just like I'm doing that. But it does, like when I play this game, it does feel like I'm fighting mobs. I'm collecting interesting equipment that I'm actually excited to collect and equip to myself. And I'm actually facing a real threat at the end of the game that provides some like real challenge.
Right. I think part of it is that, so there is one place that they definitely streamlined or simplified, which is the world itself, the like exploration and traveling. Because this doesn't have like any branching paths or side dungeons or quests or towns. It just has you move, you fight, you rest.
Sure.
But I think everything else this game does is like a really good adaptation of the feel of it, the gameplay and all that. You know, you fight, you get loot, like all you said. And so it feels to me like they kind of isolated what they at least felt was important and then worked that into the game. So they said, mm-hmm. you know, I want a skill tree to be in the game, and I want skill builds. I want different loot that you can, you know, equip over the course of the game. I want this big final boss. And you can definitely tell that, you know, those were the aspects they felt, you know, they wanted to include because that's what came up. But those are the things that make me think of Diablo, is like the skill tree and all the variables there.
Sure.
Or like managing my inventory and deciding what I need and what I can sell off to make potions. There's a lot of, yeah, a lot of like the narrative stuff is different, which I think is fine for this game. Because it's more about distilling the gameplay itself.
Sure. And I think, I mean, at some point, like, that would make the difference between a game like this and a game like Gloomhaven, which takes, you know, the RPG element very seriously to create quests and such. Right. This game, you know, it's about, like, the greater overarching story, I guess. So no need to get into the details of that and make this more like a multi-session kind of thing with quests. I guess I could see like maybe the space for it.
Yeah, I could see a legacy adaption
that takes this long to play and still gets in all the elements is what they've done. And I think that they hit the pace pretty well of the game.
Right.
To an extent. It always feels like the board is a little small to me.
Yeah, it does kind of. Like, you don't have enough time.
Right. But I mean, if it were any longer, then you'd be able to unlock like all of your skills and equip all the weapons you want, and the final fight would be a cinch. So they've actually sort of managed to balance some sort of like crazy tightrope where it's very specifically balanced to make the Demon Lord, you know, this difficult.
Yeah.
They have some ways of scaling up the difficulty, but no ways of scaling it down. So they kind of nailed how difficult they need to make the fight to be at the end. And that's based on how long the journey is, which sometimes feels a little too short, but, you know, generally I feel like when I play the game, every time I get to the end, I feel like I'm just either one skill short or one gem short of equipping all the equipment I want.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very well calculated that way. Let's see, I did want to say, so one of the big things that I love about this game is how everything is multi-purpose, or mm-hmm. nearly everything. Yes. So, like, the demons are, you fight them, but then they also contain the equipment you get from them, and they tell you how much experience you get. And experience not only levels up your skills, but also counts as money, and that acts as a way to balance the higher tier skills from the lower ones.
Yeah, because if you're leveling up the higher tier skills, you're not getting gems to equip your equipment.
Right. And so they could have had, like, a money resource, an experience resource, an item deck, you know, all that. But they really save space by doing this with, like, the same few components.
Mm-hmm. It also kind of, like, loops back on itself because of that, like, the way that, like, the demon gives you that experience, but then on the opposite side, the same amount of experience it gave you was the amount of gems that you need to equip the equipment.
Right.
So it's like it goes from, like, the demon card to your experience pool up back to the equipment, which also makes sense why the equipment is stored above your experience pool, you know, before you equip it.
Right, because that's where the gems end up.
Mm-hmm.
They go up. But, like, I think that helps with strategizing, like, being able to accurately know, okay, I'm getting this slot of item, and it's going to give me this much experience, which I can spend on these. It gives you a lot of information. Pretty much the only thing it doesn't give you is the dice you're going to roll next turn,
mm-hmm.
which is helpful. You know, it limits the amount of RNG the player has to consider. It gives you a lot of mitigation for most of the game so that you're able to mostly control the remaining mitigation, or it doesn't mm-hmm. feel like you're constantly getting swarmed by just die rolls.
I think it's also, speaking of like RNG, important to point out that like at any given tier of item or type of item at any given tier of any given color, there's usually only like one or two different kinds of items you'll actually be getting in that scenario. So like, for example, I think there's there's three different kinds of each weapon for each color at tier one, and then there's two different kinds at tier two and two different kinds at tier three. For at tier three, for each piece of armor for any given color, there's only one of that armor, so you'll know exactly what you're getting after you've played the game a couple times when you get to the tier three items, and then you'll have an idea of what you'll be getting from tier one and tier two from those items. So like, even though it just says you're getting a red hat, a tier two red hat, you can almost guarantee that that tier two red hat is going to be able to block four damage with two stamina, because that's just what the red hats do in tier two.
Right. Yeah, there's a pretty good amount of consistency in that way. Also, just like the way the whole like equipping gems that you get as experience works is, like we said, a way to encourage the player to focus on two branches of their skill tree without making mm-hmm. them feel like they're forced to do so. Like you know, it's smart to focus on just two colors because then you have enough gems to equip the equipment you want, but you can choose which of those two branches you want.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I want to notice that each character has like a really strong skill at the top of the skill tree, which just kind of helps out that new player experience as well. But that also means that
if you don't know where to go, like, this one kind of stands out to you.
Right, but that also means that they're encouraged to move those gems into the gem pool earlier on. Mm-hmm. So like, the outlaw has the poison dagger as a tier one skill. And so if you're playing the outlaw, you'll be like, oh, this can just change ones to sixes for free. I want to unlock that. But now you have gems to use on your weapons.
Yeah. In the outlaw's case, I do like that because they have the focus on ones and sixes. Then it puts like an emphasis on the equipment that can set a die to a six or a one, because it's like doubly purposeful for you. I think the same thing exists with the dancer being able to get like all plus equipment, because they can change pluses into minuses. I wish the same thing kind of existed for barbarians, like being able to use block to modify dice would be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is some neat little like sort of like build, like emergent build ideas that come from the skills that certain characters have.
Yeah, guideposts. Regardless,
beyond just like thinking of like, oh, I'm getting a lot of red skills, I should get red equipment. It's more like, oh, I got this skill, so I should look for this kind of equipment.
They're hooks. They're kind of hinting at possible builds for you. In that regard, I do want to mention just the implementation of build orders.
Okay.
So this is like a pretty common way to add replayability to strategy games, is create this complex decision tree where it's easy for those decisions to make something happen, but it's hard to do optimally. So, like, in Sanctum, it's easy for the player to level up skills so that they at least have those as a way to help deal damage and block things. But it's hard to do so that they also can equip a lot of equipment, or so that they optimize their skill loadout by the end of the game. The fact that each gem has, like, this cascading effect, but the player can level up whichever they want, gives a lot of options as well that way, but it also means that there's a lot of room for mastery as far as like timing goes.
Yeah,
and this is obviously something that action RPGs like Diablo have done since the genre's inception, is have these different skill trees where you can't level up the entire skill tree, so you have to sort of focus on specific things. And mm-hmm. you know, a large part of replayability for some people is just trying out different builds in theory, crafting those builds. And so it's very fitting that this game has build orders be such like a focus, but also I think the way it's implemented is very well done in that regard.
Sure. It's also good that it feels like a focus, because that's the thing that differentiates one player from the next. So you'd want there to be that emphasis there, that it feels like when you're playing the outlaw versus the dancer, like you're making different decisions and doing different things. You know, makes it feel right. More important that you're a different character.
Right. Also, the blessings encourage this. Mm-hmm. Because the blessings are first come, first serve, it kind of incentivizes planning out your early turns to work towards those. This is the same thing that happens with Food Chain Magnate, is that because there are these things you can reach by doing specific milestones first. It says, like, okay, I want to get this blessing. How do I reach that? And that sort of helps inform the decision making. So that way it makes it so that, like, you're not completely in the dark as far as what you should start doing. You know, if you're playing the game for the first time, you have sort of one other goal, not just to unlock a skill, but to meet this goal of getting this milestone or the blessing.
I have two criticisms for this game.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is that the... The first one is that the two-player game balance is a little weird. I haven't played the game four-player, but it makes me think... Because I'm pretty sure with the four-player game, you go through all five acts, which means that you go through three divine intervention spots instead of two. But I might be wrong. You might skip one of them in the four-player. But if you go through three of them, then the four-player game, I feel like, would be easier than the three-player game, because you end up with more dice than in the three-player game. When, you know, you end up with more dice, but you... The four-player game, because you add the extra player, you add the extra board, it turns out you move the same number of spaces as you would have moved in the three-player game. So you have the same amount of experience, the same amount of equipment, you just have one extra die, which makes it slightly easier.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the one thing going against that is that you don't have as much selection of items, maybe. Like, there's more people to counterpick your items, which could also mean counterpicking your experience. So there's that, but that doesn't seem like such a big deal.
There's more people going for blessings.
I suppose there's also that, but an extra die is worth way more than an extra blessing. To that effect, the two-player game balance is totally weird, in my opinion, because when you set up the game for a two-player game, so you take out two of the acts, but you still go through a mid-game act that gives you a divine blessing, plus the divine blessing at the fifth act means that you get the same number of extra dice as a three-player game. However, for the game setup, you take three of the blessings from the blessing board away, one for every tier, and you put a die in there at random. So you put like a die in one of the first tier blessing spaces, one of the second tier blessing spaces, one of the third tier blessing spaces. So you're getting like way more extra dice. But you're also putting this big emphasis on these blessings to get these extra dice, and there's a chance that one player can get all three of them. In fact, when we play, it's pretty often that one player will get either all three of them and the other player gets none, or one player will get two of them and the other player will get none. Like, they won't be able to catch up to the third player and catch the third one in the tier three slot. It's especially weird because those dice could technically be in the same column. So, like, if some person gets ahead, you know, in one of those columns and gets the first die, they're probably going to get the second die too. So having that that mismatch in the number of dice that the players can have seems like a huge balance issue, in my opinion. Like, the dice are so strong. Extra dice is so strong in this game. And if you can fight the Demon Lord with one more dice than your opponent, like, that makes a huge difference in the fight, from what I've seen. We've played around, me and the person I've been playing with, putting only all the dice in the third tier, which makes the most sense to us. We've also made sure that they're each in a different column for tier one, tier two, and tier three, but that still ended up favoring one player over the other.
Yeah.
So it's a little odd, that design decision. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, again, you're only going through, you move the same amount of spaces as you would in a three-player game. So you have the same level of equipment and armor. Okay, the other point of criticism that I have is that the final fight is very different than the rest of the game.
Yep.
So, I mean, first of all, the pace is a lot slower. Like, you're traveling across the landscape, you're fighting all these easy combats for the most, they're pretty much all easy. Like, it feels like you rarely need to use potions, or, like, you know, one potion could make the difference of taking, like, one damage before you get to the top. That's it. And then you get to the demon and you take like a ton of damage. Also, for the first five acts of the game, there's the abilities on your equipment that modify the dice are high priority because you collect a lot of demons, and in order to take little damage, you just need to defeat them. So you just need the abilities that change your dice so you can defeat them. But when you get to the Demon Lord, it changes. Now you absolutely have to have a ton of block skills because you're going to be facing a lot of damage
just yeah.
every turn.
Yeah, this is my main complaint as well, that it's a completely different shift in what you emphasize while playing the game.
Block is actually worse in the initial part of the game because you want to be defeating your demons and just moving forward. If you have to take multiple combats to defeat your demons because you don't have the dice modification, you just have a bunch of block, then you're like falling way behind in tempo against your right. opponents.
This got me the first time I played, was that I thought I was fine because I had these good weapons and like I was able to take care of all the demons I drew, and then I get to the final boss and it's like I take 8 damage and I die.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize I needed so much block. So I mean, like, a player doesn't have to be 100% strategically prepared on their first playthrough, but it is such a huge shift that can lead to player elimination that mm-hmm. like it's not really telegraphed or anything, or not emphasized. Right. You almost need somebody who's played the game to mention it.
Yeah. If anything, you should have to set up the demon cards that you face off against before you do your final rest to choose the equipment that you will go into the fight with, just so you can see how much damage you're facing and how many dice rolls you're going to have to be making.
Right. Because
that should inform you, like, oh, I need to bring a lot of block. But then, yeah, even before that, if you weren't prioritizing cards that give you enough block, then you're kind of SOL when you get to the final team and fight. Exactly. So yeah, it helps to have that little piece of like strategic advice, like, hey, you're going to want like 8 block on the first turn of your final fight.
Yeah. Let's see. The other thing is I just don't like the usage of purple on the abilities. Even I got it mixed up with red pretty often, and I don't even have... Is it just
too close to color, you mean?
Like, yeah, like, color-wise, I'm not really colorblind, but I have problems sometimes with the purple and red in this game.
Gotcha.
So I can't imagine what it's like for people who do have, like, that sort of issues.
Yeah, I know our dad has a colorblindness that affects his... I think he sees purple as blue.
Yeah. So this game's color palette for like the important mechanical stuff is just kind of asking for accessibility issues.
Right.
And it doesn't really have unique symbols either. Like most games, when they have different colors to denote things, they have symbols as well.
Yeah, like the blue might be like hexagonal, whereas the red is a circle.
Yeah. Or something like that. But this doesn't do that. And I think the stamina and the focus have the same sort of fireball icon, just different right. colors. So that's unfortunate.
Yeah, there's opportunities to make this game a little more accessible there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, in the art department, this game kind of crushes it.
Right. I love the character illustrations.
The character illustrations look good. The miniatures look really good. They have really good amounts of detail. The map itself looks just like, you know, like a world map from like a Diablo game. Like it's just vibrant enough with enough like fantasy details. The equipment looks really cool. The demons look really cool.
I love the equipment of a certain color will make like a full outfit where it's all the same style.
Yeah, like the leather on the green equipment, it all kind of and the patterns all kind of match together.
Yeah,
when you always have a bunch of green armor.
I always joke that the green level 3 armor looks like the Bloodborne Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fun. Yeah.
All right. Do you have anything else to say about the game?
I want to see more characters. That's the only other thing.
Yeah, I'm excited. Despite our criticisms, it's a really fun game that I've played a ton of. Like, mm-hmm. I've played this game so many times in the last few weeks. And I'm always excited to try it out again and try a different build of a character that I'm not familiar with.
It really gives me the theory crafting bug.
Yeah. So I'm excited to see more added to the game. More characters or more skills for the existing characters or what have you. So we'll be on the lookout for that, but
this is one of the 2 games I've played that I think works best at 3. We've covered the other game on our podcast.
Yes.
I'm not going to say what it is.
At three players. All right. So thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
That's our episode on Sanctum. We'll see you next time for a new episode.